This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Since the city's beginnings, Black St. Louisans have been instrumental to shaping the region's culture, politics, and way of life. As we move into the latter half of this year's Black History Month, we'd like to bring you our 2023 conversation with the co-authors of the Reedy Press book, Black St. Louis, historian Nini Harris, and the executive director of the George B. Vachon Museum, Calvin Riley. Through documents, photos, and artifacts, the book tells the story of enslaved people, nightclub owners, and soldiers who shaped the region from St. Louis's founding in 1764 to the start of the 21st century. It highlights joyful moments in the lives of Black people in the area, stories that need to be told so they're not forgotten. I started our conversation by asking Calvin about his family's St. Louis origins.
Well, I grew up in the city of St. Louis. My mother moved here from Mississippi in 1960, and so I grew up downtown St. Louis. Went to Patrick Henry School, and then we moved into St. Louis Cochran Housing Projects, and where we lived pretty fairly good lives. So we thought, I mean, it was clean. We couldn't mess up the walls. If we did, we had to clean them, you know. So my mom taught us about going to get an education. She spoke strongly about that, for us to get an education, because she wanted to be a writer herself.
Oh.
She told me she wanted to be a writer, but she, some things happened where she didn't do that. So I feel like I've done that for her.
Right. So, and I think there's a lot of that that is certainly part of this book. Nini, for your part, what is your connection to St. Louis? How is it that your family came here?
I'm born and bred here, and I went to St. Louis Public Schools, Calvin Woodward Grade School. And in eighth grade, we had St. Louis history. And if we didn't pass that test for that subject, I didn't think we were ever going to get to go out of grade school onto a greater, more life. I thought it was eighth grade forever. But more, I learned history from the old folks who lived in the neighborhood, who used to tell their stories. They'd make cookies as they told their stories, and they'd be feeding you sweets and talking about the Depression or the 20s or the war. And you heard so much in just listening to them.
And that history is something, Calvin, you are very... you're very committed to. Not only have you lived as a Black St. Louisan, but you are the founder and director of a whole museum that's devoted to that.
Yes, we have plenty of documents that we can research to tell stories of what African Americans are doing here in St. Louis, in the Mill Creek Valley, and Kirkwood, Richmond Heights, all those various areas, East St. Louis, you know, and so. Because it's rich. It's still in North St. Louis. And I tell people all the time, do not throw things away, because this stuff is in people's basements. It's in their attics right now as I speak, in boxes. And a lot of people don't even, they're not even aware that it's there.
Right, right.
Calvin found and took interest in things just like little snapshots from a family dinner in the 1950s. And on their own, those snapshot, an individual photo might not tell a lot, but when you put them together, and he would go to these yard sales and just buy or get whatever you could, each one was like a little puzzle piece. Now, of course, the photographs, those are more recent.
Right.
The old courthouse, the National Park Service, has tremendous documentation on the colonial era.
Mm-hmm.
And they, and particularly Dr. Bob Moore, were very helpful with locating material about African Americans in the earliest days.
Yeah, right.
So we are taking things from all different directions and all different aspects of this incredible story.
Mm-hmm. Now, Is there an example, perhaps, of a story that you discovered through old records that you were poring over or poring through, Nini? A record maybe that would not have looked like much of anything if you were not kind of looking at it the right way.
Jeanette Fourchette.
Mm-hmm.
And I found several records of her in documents that are at the old courthouse. And she was a person of African ancestry from, she was in Cahokia, Illinois, the east side of the area. And she had been given her freedom, and she came here right after Laclede founded St. Louis. And he gave her a grant of land, as he was doing with numerous people. So she had a plot of ground in the village, this free woman of color, and a piece of farmland. And she was married to another free man, another free person of color, Gregoire, who was a blacksmith.
Mm-hmm.
When he passed away, I found the marriage license information. She remarried another person of color who was free, who was a gunsmith. So here is the evidence, here is the documentation from the earliest days of this free African American community that had so many skills and were playing such a part in creating our community.
Mm-hmm.
And old cemeteries also contain a lot of history. I was just met with the Wildwood Historical Society, and they were telling me about an African American cemetery out there that they're afraid that it's going to get lost.
Mm.
And so, but those old cemeteries, they have tombstones that tell you about these people who lived during these early times.
So there's a connection. Wildwood is a bit of a distance from
right.
where we are.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the extent to which this is not only about St. Louis City, but also this area
right.
and this region mm-hmm. and the way that people moved as they were making their lives here. Calvin, is there anything among the artifacts that sort of harkens back to the life of Jeanette Fourchette? Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of lifestyle they may have had even, you know, back at that time?
Well, they might have been free at that time, but they were still treated badly. They were segregated, and they couldn't do things. They couldn't go places where they wanted to go. They had to go in particular areas. So were they free in a certain sense they were, but in a certain sense they were not free
mm-hmm.
because they had to deal with that segregation.
Right.
Holding them back. They couldn't go to school, stuff like that, you know what I mean, until a certain period, you know, because Missouri had a law where it was illegal to teach African Americans how to read or write,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that's, you know, sad times that they were dealing with at that time. We
right.
don't think about that.
Well, and the public school system started in 1838,
mm-hmm.
and of course it was very small and only dealt with a very limited number of students.
Right.
But then the state in the 1840s outlawed teaching of African Americans, even though there was this growing free community and a political atmosphere in St. Louis
right.
that was very opposed to the state policies.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't until 1866 that public schools were opened for people of African ancestry. But back in Jeanette Fourchette's time, in the colonial era, what I did was just read every document I could from that era to see what life was like at that time to try to get a picture of what life was like for a free woman of color mm-hmm. and someone who was enslaved. And the 1787 census that was conducted by the Spanish gave a lot of clues.
Mm-hmm.
And it told, you know, just how this seed of this free community had started. But and you saw most of the people who were enslaved being divided up like one person to a family. There were very few instances where you saw large groups of people enslaved with one person owning them. The men appeared to do mostly farm work. The mm-hmm. women did the laundry, the hauling of water, the cooking, all the taking care of the chickens, the cows. That they had farm lots mm-hmm. in downtown sure. that were 120 by 150 feet, and they had animals and herb gardens there. And the enslaved women would have been caring for those.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, something with this book, the photographs are really, really interesting. And I say interesting because the span of history that it is covering, Nina, you're talking about the colonial times, we're talking about Jeanette Fourchette. There were some who were free, who were able to move in a particular way. But for most African-American people in St. Louis, that was not the life that they could enjoy. And so one of the photographs, speaking of school, that really stands out to me are different pictures of classes. How is it that you have come to have so many of these kinds of photographs, Calvin, in the museum, and that have also been included in the book?
Because I conduct estate sales, and I clean out houses. I do buyouts and homes. And so in doing that, I look for early documents. And I look at in attics. I usually find them in attics and basements, been in trunks for many, many years, kind of like when I found the Vachon artifacts. The Vachons came to St. Louis because St. Louis public school teachers, the white teachers, did not want to teach the black children. And the Board of Education had to threaten them with their jobs to go and teach the children. So the parents start protesting. Mm-hmm. And then that's how the Vachons came here in 1880 yeah. and became, John Vachon became principal of Delaney School mm-hmm. and principal of Color School Number 10, which later became Vachon Elementary.
We need to take a quick break. We'll return shortly to my conversation with Nini Harris and Calvin Riley, co-authors of Black St. Louis, when we return. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome back. Today we're listening back to my conversation with Calvin Riley and Nini Harris, co-authors of the 2023 Reedy Press book titled Black St. Louis. It's a volume full of photos, documents, and images of artifacts alongside text descriptions of the rich and inspiring history of African Americans in St. Louis, from the time of the city's founding to the start of the 21st century.
Support comes from Gemma. Architects, planners, and designers seeking to bring joy to their clients and communities. Details at jemastl.com.
Let's dive back into the discussion. Now, before the break, Calvin, you were talking about finding photos, and in particular, class photos at estate sales. And clearly, these were kept because they were important mm-hmm. to people. And there are many of these kinds of photos in this book. What is important about artifacts like this?
Well, they show that African Americans had pride. They wanted to go to school. They enjoyed learning. They wanted to learn. They wanted to do better. The parents are pushing that for the kids. Because despite being poor, a lot of the parents still wanted their kids to progress and to get an education. Mm-hmm. So that's very, very important. And that's what those photographs demonstrate. They demonstrate that. You know, you see them going, even college photographs. I got them from middle school, high school, elementary school. Mm-hmm. So it shows how families made that progression.
Right, right. And the schools being anchors in neighborhoods that were very specifically built and developed by Black St. Louisans is also something that stood out. In terms of what you found in documentation or in stories that you heard from people, Nini, what is it about the schools that people should be thinking about apart from just leaving with a diploma?
Oh, it was a focus of life. And if you think back to like 1860, slavery, this is a slave state, and 2% of the population is African American. Only 2% more are free than living enslaved. But even the free, they cannot openly go to school. Beginning during the Civil War, we have waves of migrants coming up from the Deep South for possibilities and opportunities in St. Louis to work and to go to school. And you see this excitement about school, and many of the people who were coming up for generations after the Civil War, they had been born, the parents or grandparents had been born in slavery, and now they could send their children to school in the morning. What an inspiring moment for them to think, I am going to achieve and my children are going to learn. Mm-hmm. This is an extraordinary movement in history. Mm-hmm. And our schools, they did great work. St. Louis Public, I'm very proud of so many wonderful programs they had.
And this is something, obviously, the schools, it's been covered in other books. Calvin, for your part, was there some particular reason that it was important to include this in this book that you co-authored?
Yes, because a lot of the people who I found artifacts of, they attended these segregated schools. They attended Sumner. They attended Vashon. They went to Kirkwood, you know, in Mission Park, in those schools. So these people that experienced that, and they live that life. So it's very, very important to show that people need to see it so it's not forgotten and it must be talked about. Mm-hmm. Across the country right now, they're trying to decide what should be taught in schools for African-American history. And my thing, I just say, tell the truth. Mm-hmm. That's all you got to do. You don't have to make anything up. The documentation is there. Just tell the truth. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much.
Is there a story or some information, Nini, in the book that sort of speaks to what Calvin is talking about, maybe something that fills gaps that exist even with sort of the number of books that already exist out there?
Well, you know, St. Louis Public Schools, again, start opening schools to serve Black children in 1866. And the case is made very clearly by the school superintendent and then the president of the board that African Americans are paying taxes. They have a right to attend schools. Mm-hmm. And then they open more and more schools. And in 1875, the first high school for African Americans west of the Mississippi, Sumner. A few years after that, they are hiring teachers of African ancestry, and they find enrollment increases so among African Americans because now they have these role models teaching them. Mm-hmm. And then 1890, we have Stowe Teachers College. It was then called Normal School. That mm-hmm. was what schools for to become teachers were called normal schools. And I am impressed that the board saw the value in this and the importance. And it's interesting to me. I went through the minutes of board meetings and found that like an African-American school and a white school built same time, very close to one another, they spent the same amount per classroom on construction for each. And that was surprising, and I was very happy to see it. Mm-hmm. It did surprise me, but I was happy to see that they had per classroom put aside the same amount of money.
Investment.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. So that was there were a number of things I found uplifting that we can take inspiration from.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about the world of African Americans in St. Louis, something that also stood out to me among the photographs was the different kinds of photos there were. So the people who took them, there are some notes about that. The notes on them, that was very interesting. So, for example, there's a photo that has written on it, "Come, let's dance because I am in the mood." And "in" is underlined three times. There's also a photograph of a soldier in uniform standing in front of a bar, but he is so positioned so that horns are behind him. So the kind of humor that was involved, right, the way that the photographs not only demonstrate that Black St. Louisans were part of sort of a movement, but they were also just enjoying themselves. Mm-hmm. Is that something that was important for you to incorporate here?
Yes, it just shows that they were real people, even though a lot of them had come out of slavery. They were real people that had feelings, and they enjoyed things just like other races did. They liked to have good times. I mean, they weren't able to go and rent out hotel rooms, but they would have what you call backyard parties, and they meet at each other's homes and have parties in their homes and things like that. So they enjoyed life just like everyone else. In Mill Creek Valley, they said they had honky-tonk clubs down there. I mean, it was just where they had dance and they just enjoyed themselves. So they wanted to enjoy life like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But they were still suppressed in certain areas.
Right, right.
They built, in spite of everything, they built senses of community.
Mm-hmm.
Right after the Civil War, you see that through lodges and churches and brotherhoods, they're building community that strengthens one another. It's remarkable and, again, inspiring what they did.
Mm-hmm. The social milieu of Black St. Louisans is also something that was brought up in this book. And I'm thinking specifically about Glamorgan, and that was Cyprian Glamorgan, who was the grandson of a prominent West Indies native who arrived in St. Louis in 1780. And Cyprian Glamorgan wrote something called The Colored Aristocracy of St. Louis. Tell us a little bit about that, Nini.
Well, it was published in 1858, and he was writing specifically about the free community in St. Louis that had evolved here. And it's very gossipy. So it gives you all sorts of insights into life. He defined aristocracy, unlike later in local life, he defined it purely by wealth. And he described one man, it was just amazing, William Johnson Sr. He told that he had opened a barber shop. Mm-hmm. In 1840. He had been a barber. He opened a shop and said that he was very careful with his money and was really careful and saved $1,000. And Johnson had the wisdom to buy a block of market and sell it then for $100,000.
And the book also goes into the immigrants who came to this country, the kinds of relationships there were between immigrants from outside the United States with Black folks who were here sort of given what the economic circumstances were, and then some of the limitations, obviously, you know, Calvin, you had touched upon, whether you were free or not, there were still restrictions that made it difficult to make the best life possible. In the book, there is a photo, and it's a description of exodusters, which I thought was a really interesting term. Mm-hmm. Calvin, you described your family's coming here, your mother's coming from Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Why is that an important thing to think about, sort of in this context of people who have come here and made St. Louis their home?
Because they was trying to get out of the South. And my mother had a bad experience. Her girlfriend had moved to St. Louis and told her to come. She said, well, and she didn't think she was going to move yet. So she was picking cotton, and she said she had picked cotton very hard that week because she wanted to make some money to do some things. And so when she went to get paid, the plantation owner told her she had used up her money by getting things from the store, And she was so angry. And she took her kids to her mother's home, and then she came to St. Louis and got everything together, and she came back and brought her children. Mm-hmm. And so, but it was just trying to, and there was a lot of that people trying to get out of the South because it was just so bad for African Americans. They weren't making any money. They work hard, but they weren't getting paid for it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was the main reason why people were leaving the southern states, coming to St. Louis and Chicago and Detroit, those kind of northern states.
Mm-hmm. And was there anything in the documents that you found really interesting that shows something about that migration that's included in the book, Nini?
Well, I included personal stories of people who had been brought here as children. Charlie Jones, from my own neighborhood, Charlie Jones, I was shocked to find out he was born in Mississippi. We all knew him as the mayor of Carondelet. Carondelet is my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And he, through his church and involvement in so many neighborhood things, took such a leadership role. Clark Terry's family mm-hmm. had moved here. He lived in Carondelet before in Mill Creek, and Clark Terry became the first black musician in the NBC band. We used to watch him on Johnny Carson every night, guy from the neighborhood.
Yeah.
There were so many stories of this migration mm-hmm. from the South and the making a new life here.
Well, there's certainly a lot to explore here. And just the last word from each of you, what is it that you hope people will get from this book, Calvin?
The truth. The truth. Because there are a lot of St. Louis history that people are unaware of, and I think they need to know what the truth is and read it and be inspired about it and know that what African Americans had gone through and despite still became successful.
Mm-hmm. And Nini?
Same thing, facts and inspiration. Right. That's mm-hmm. the two words.
That was my 2023 conversation with Nini Harris and Calvin Riley, co-authors of the book Black St. Louis.
This episode was produced by Elaine Cha.
And by Emily Woodbury. Edited by Lila Halabasic.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Doerr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.